Hello and welcome to another edition of Beautiful Minds, an exploration into the minds of creative people and what makes them tick. The show is brought to you by Audio Journal and sponsored by the Memorial Foundation for the Blind. Opinions expressed on this program do not reflect the views and or opinions of Audio Journal, its board of directors, staff, or volunteer readers. The goal of our program is to offer insight into the beautiful and creative minds of all types of artistic people right here in the New England area. I'm your host, Tom Hurley. My guest today is Phil Antonides and his daughter, Amelia. I was absolutely fascinated by everything that they had to tell me. Let's jump right in. Check it out. Thank you so much for coming and doing this. I really appreciate it. Go ahead and introduce yourselves so I'll get your names right.
Well, I'll let Amelia go first.
My name's Amelia. I go by Amelia Ali on with my music releases, and I'm here on behalf of my dad, Philip Antoniadis, who was invited here in the first place. Why did you make me go first?
Because I knew you'd introduce me, so we're good.
Nice.
So, Phil, you and I have some mutual friends. That's how we were introduced.
Yeah.
And my understanding is that you're a musician, among other things. So
that happens, yes.
Yeah, it does, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Can you tell me a little bit about your background, where you're from?
Sure.
You don't have to, but you can tell me how old you are. That's what
No, I'm old. Just starting to feel it. My family is starting to really ask what I will do when I grow up. I'm 62. I grew up in the Bay Area. Was really into music as a kid. Played classical guitar. By some miracle, I was supposed to play flugelhorn or something.
Mm-hmm.
And I was going to get braces, and I didn't want to put wax on my braces. And my best friend was like, "Why don't you play drums?" And I was like, "Sure, I'll play drums." And it's like the fourth grade. And by the sixth grade, I dropped classical guitar, which I was really, really good at.
Hmm.
And I can't read a note of it now.
Oh, okay.
I was doing recitals as a classical guitar player, like crazy recitals, and studying with like a world-renowned teacher. And hey, I played drums, and it was a blast.
Yeah.
And, you know, kind of from there on, I really like playing drums. And even as a kid, like in the sixth grade, our music teacher, the music director, he was a music director at like six schools in California. And he didn't want to teach six different schools worth of drummers. So he'd take us around to every school for all their performances and like give us a little money and feed us, and we'd get out of school. And it was like, hey, we got gigs. We're in the sixth grade. We got gigs. You know? So it was really fun. Anyway, I just kept playing, and I never really took it seriously, which was weird because I'd played like some professional gigs really young, and I got lucky at 15. My drum teacher went to Japan and gave my name to a wedding band and said, "You ought to get this kid to come play with you." And they did, and they would like, I mean, they were younger than I am now, and I thought they were like just so old. I'm like, I'm playing with grandparents, you know. It's like, you know, and they would pick me up from my house and take me to rehearsal, and it was like, and I had no idea. I was just having fun, but I had, you know, no idea what was going on. And God, the patience they must have had putting up with me, you know. But I was getting paid. I was getting, you know, doing wedding gigs and stuff and playing clubs where I couldn't get off the stage because I was too young to be in the bar and, you know, stuff like that. And anyway, that's my musical background. I became an entrepreneur really young. I started an auto body shop when I was a kid.
Oh.
Just realized that, like, I could, like, at 14, I really liked doing it. And I realized I could just go around the neighborhood and say, "Hey, you know, you wrecked. What's your insurance estimate? I'll do it for one third that price." You know? And they'd be like, "What?" And I'd be like, "Listen, I'll do it over again if I do it wrong." And people were like, with that warranty, they were like, "Oh, sure."
Yeah.
And I really never had to do anything over again. Sometimes it took a little while.
Yeah.
But I learned how to do it through like a yet another, you know, thing, like a Sea Scouts in California was really a lot of fun, and I learned how to fix boats, and I was like, why fix boats when I can fix cars? By 16, the local State Farm guy was sending me work.
Wow.
And my parents, like, weren't really paying attention, and I had an auto body shop in their two-car garage behind the house. They didn't really understand. It was a nice hobby, and I was making money hand over fist. It was,
wow,
it was great, you know. And so, and as a kid, right, my mom would take me to the supply store, and they thought it was so funny that, like, this guy's mom's got to drive him here. And they would, like, tell me, oh, there's a class on painting from the paint company, and I would go. Mm-hmm. And I learned all this stuff, you know, like, and it was fun, fascinating to me. Like, you know, so I sort of got, you know, obsessed with the whole thing. But I also was really into the fact that, like, I could pay my brother $15 and he would completely wash and wax a car.
Mm-hmm.
So when I finished a car, customer service wise, I'd return it completely waxed. And my, I learned really early, like, if I wanted help, just ask people, what do you want to do this? And if the price was right, I'd just say yes. Don't bargain. Or if it was wrong, just say no.
Yeah.
So people come work for me, and, you know, fine. Like, you want $10 an hour? Fine, get $10 an hour. So wow, that kind of took off, and then I really wanted to join the Navy if they'd let me in the band, but they wouldn't guarantee I would get in the band.
Mm-hmm.
They're like, well, you have high SAT scores, and, you know, you could be into nuclear fission, you know, and I'd be like, but I don't want to do nuclear fission. I want to do band. I want to be like Steve Gadd. I want to 4 years of playing drums, you know.
Right.
So I didn't do it.
Yeah.
And I went to UC Berkeley and challenged my way into the big band.
Hmm.
And they had a really great jazz program there. It had nothing to do with the school, you know, curriculum. It was just extracurricular, right? But they had really good, really great directors and great musicians. Some of the cats I played with in high school, I didn't know in the high school jazz band that I was playing with all these amazing artists that, like, ended up doing really well in life. And, like, there they were at school. And I challenged my way into the second, you know, from the third band to the second band. And then I heard the first band was going to Japan and China. And I was like, I got to get in that band.
Mm.
And so it was a brutal, like, four or five different challenges, and I got it, you know, and the whole time I'm going to school, and I could care less what I'm taking in school,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, because at UC Berkeley, you were studying not music at all.
Yeah, at UC Berkeley, I was studying, I don't know, the first year was engineering, and I didn't want to work with any of the people around me, so then, you know, second year, I was in a band with this show band, which is like a cover band out here, and,
yeah,
and the bass player was taking psychology, so I copied his schedule. That was fun. I liked that year. And then I took cultural anthropology because we were going to Japan and I wanted to learn about China and Japan. Anyway, really long story short, went to Japan. We were used to playing for a couple hundred people. There were like 10,000.
Wow.
And it was one day in Japan, we were on FM Tokyo. The next day, we were sponsored by Nike. The next day, things just went nuts. And it was like being a rock star playing big band jazz. It was bizarre and fun, you know.
Yeah.
So when I came back, I'm like, I want to be that. That's what I want to do. I want to play drums, you know.
Yeah.
Like, and at that point, I was playing drums 5 nights a week, and I still wasn't thinking of it as a profession.
Uh-huh.
I was doing 2 nights a week jazz and 3 nights a week playing in a cover band, and had never even considered it.
Hmm.
So,
and to sum it up, you went to that Berkeley for what? Almost the full 4 years?
I went the full 4 years and didn't graduate.
Okay.
And then?
I dropped out. My mother wouldn't talk to me. My father quite nicely told me, son, I was given a choice of, when he grew up in Cyprus, and he's like, it'd give you a choice of going to Vienna to study piano at 16 or to the United States to go to college.
Mm-hmm.
And he went to the United States at 16 and went to college for chemistry and became a doctorate, you know.
Mm.
But he's like, sometimes I think I made the wrong choice. So you want to do this? Fine with me.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's good.
And everything from there on was amazing.
Yeah.
I went to Berkeley. I mean, I looked at a bunch of schools. I chose Berkeley.
Berkeley College of Music.
College of Music, right. I had sent in a tape from FM Tokyo because I was worried they might not let me in to Berkeley. And 2 days after I got there, I had a half scholarship in my mailbox from the Steve Smith scholarship, and then another letter, and it was another half scholarship from the Louis Belson scholarship, and I had a full scholarship to go to school. It was awesome.
Yeah, that's
and it was kind of like, oh, I think I made the right choice. Yeah. You know, and then that was in the days when Pell Grants would give you money back. Mm-hmm. So it's like going to the bursar to collect your money to go to school. It was like, this is the coolest thing ever, you know?
Yeah.
Anyway, and man, what a great experience. Berkeley was eye-opening.
Uh-huh.
Sadly, I went very quickly to not playing jazz anymore, even though I had a full jazz scholarship, because I was used to really playing, and there were years of just people trying to outplay each other there, and I wasn't into it.
Mm-hmm.
Got into music synthesis, and I bought one of the first set of electronic drums in Oakland, California. So, and I knew if I bought them, I could rent them out to studios. Right. Again, more sidelines, because painting cars and working on cars as I went to college at UC Berkeley turned into painting drums and guitars and doing custom work for the shop. So I did a lot of work with the drum shop and stuff. So anyhow, without getting really lost, man. Berkeley was amazing. And I went 8 semesters straight right through the summers. Wish I had not done that, because in the end, everyone I met at school continues, you know, I'm 62, and they continue to be a network of people. All, you know, a good 60 to 70% of them are all still in the business.
Mm-hmm.
And it's amazing.
Yeah.
It's really just amazing. And there's guys I toured with, you know, 30 years ago that we still play, we still work together. It's just, you know, so cool.
And yeah, that's great. Well, the music community is really, I've found it to be a family, you know, definitely. You don't get along with everyone in your family, but most of your family you do.
Yeah.
And it's nice because you have this huge network of people that kind of, we all kind of think the same way, sort of, you know.
Yeah.
And we're, you know, there to support and help each other. So that's great. I'm glad to hear that.
Well, the entrepreneurial thing never left me.
Mm-hmm.
So it just really became, I'm always playing music and I'm always doing something.
Uh-huh.
At Berkeley, it started as I was managing an apartment building, and it became real easy to just like start doing work on people's buildings. And then musicians, they're either really good at doing work, construction work, or they're terrible. So I would just ask buddies, you know, you need work? Yeah. Well, how much you want? See how they did.
Yeah.
So I had this whole crew of people, and it was when Back Bay was getting regentrified. So we were down there just working on brownstones and all the stuff I did with auto body work and doing like fancy plaster work and restoration. Like it came in so handy. People would call me like, and I'd be rebuilding plaster frescoes with Bondo and foam. And, they're like, how'd you do that? You know, it's like, yeah, well, I hope 10 years from now, this still exists. Right. You know, but, anyway, I got really into it. And then I kind of realized like I need to do more with music.
Yeah.
And, I was working, I met a club manager in downtown Boston, and he was, you know, that was back in the days when every club had 4 bands a night, you know, 5 to 7 nights a week. It was crazy, right? So you had like Bun Ratties and the Jumbo and the Rat. I was working, I got lucky because at Berkeley, I decided to do music synthesis so I could learn more about like these new things called synthesizers. Because we're talking 82, you know, 1982. Yeah. And I was so lucky because I actually got to start over on computers, where when I graduated, you know, I was handed electric typewriter as my graduation gift. It was like, what am I going to do with this, right? You know, and I got to relearn on the first Macs, you know. And at Berkeley, they used the synthesis department as a testing ground because stuff was changing so fast. So every semester, there'd be a new, like the next upgrade of the Mac, the next upgrade of whatever keyboard Roland's making, whatever Kurzweil was making. So it was like, it was so much fun, and nobody had any idea what they were really teaching then.
Yeah.
So it was kind of like a free for all of musicians all trying to create music. So they'd say to, you know, in class, they'd be like, hey, you know, we need you to use an FM synthesizer and an analog synthesizer. We want you to pick 2 sounds and we want you to do a verse and a chorus. And like, everybody would come back with like complete songs with as many tracks as they could put on the Mac before it crashed, you know? And
yeah.
Like, and it was hilarious because, you know, and that's how I started to meet people. Like I was the drummer, and all of a sudden there was this guy, you know, who to this day is one of my best friends, who, like, every time you played a track, it had the best drum tracks ever. And mm-hmm. you're like, who the f*** is that? You know, like, wait a minute, you know?
It was Jeffy?
Yeah, it was Jeff, you know? So, and that's, and anyway, so that's how school, like, started to take effect. Like, I was a major in percussion, but in school, I was so fascinated by everything. The only way I was going to get a degree as a professional drummer would be to practice 6 hours a day.
Yeah.
And I was interested in a whole bunch of other stuff, and I've got time to practice for the rest of my life. I might look at that different today, but then that's how I saw it, right? So, they have like dog chewing filters, right?
I don't think
that
they
was awesome.
Do.
Anyway,
this whole podcast is going to be sounds of me snapping my fingers.
It's all quiet. It's all good. It's all good. So I got really irritated with the percussion department because they finally came up with it. Well, you couldn't have any electronic drums in the synthesis department because that was drums. Mm-hmm. It's like, yeah, but you got every other instrument in mm-hmm. here, but no, you know, no drums.
Yeah.
So I had to go take a electronic drum class in the drum department, which I knew more than the people who were teaching it, and I'm like, no, that's not how you use those, you know. It's like,
yeah.
And then so I wrote a scathing letter to the drum department, which was a really stupid thing to do, because then now all my proficiency tests were brutal.
Yeah,
you think that was a direct correlation there?
Oh yeah, but I still did them. I mean, I could play, you know. I mean, one of the weirdest things was getting in there and auditioning for your ratings at Berklee. And I went to audition, and the next day, I'm on the audition team because I have a scholarship.
Mm-hmm.
And once you're on the audition team, I mean, you get so used to auditioning, you're not afraid of auditioning. It's yeah. easy, you know. And if you weren't good at sight reading music, you got really good at it, you know, because you're doing 20 auditions a day, you know.
Your ADHD is showing right now. I'm not going to lie.
It is. It's all over the pad. I'm just like all over. Yeah. Yeah, I get it.
That's
good. So
speaking of sight reading, so you said at a young age you played classical guitar.
Yeah.
So you were learning music theory, obviously, and to learn how to read music.
Yeah, it's weird. It's like, you know, an appreciation for music, a love of expression through music, all came through lessons that, and performing even, you know, all came through lessons that I don't remember any of it, right? You know, and I think it's so cool. Like, when I teach drums now, and when I teach, I try to think of the same thing. It's like, yeah, but what's this kid going to learn from me, really?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it's like, and kids today are so stressed out.
Yeah.
You know, they're OCD, and everything's got to be perfect, and it's like, they're so anxious, and it's like, look, you're taking drum lessons because you're not supposed to know how to play drums, you know? Like, so it's fine.
Yeah.
You know, let's make some mistakes. And then when you take a kid who's like super OCD and you tell them that the way you get an A+ in drumming is to keep great time no matter how many mistakes you make, their heads blow up. Because it's like, but I need to stop and fix. No, you can't stop and fix anything. You're the drummer.
Yeah.
Right? You know, it's like, yeah. So, anyway.
Yeah, absolutely. I know as a musician myself, like the number one rule performing live is you can't stop in the middle of a song. I mean, I could probably count on one hand the number of times that I've stopped playing a song.
Yeah.
And typically it's because something is so completely out of tune or, you know, and
it's a complete disaster.
Yeah. And you're failing the audience in a whole new way, you know, so you just stop and say, sorry, folks, you know, I'm a string breaker. I break guitar strings constantly.
Yeah.
It's part of the show now where I'll restring my guitar mid-song, have it tuned back up, and be finishing the song with my bandmate before it's over. And I don't break as many strings as I used to. And people, hey, you're not breaking as many strings. It sounds like
you must not be playing as good. You must not be playing as hard.
They got used to it. That's so funny.
That's cool.
I want to know more, but I want to hear from your daughter, Amelia.
Yeah.
She was nice enough to join us. And how old are and if you could just get a little closer to that.
Yeah.
Mic,
thanks for having me, too. I hope it's okay that I'm here. He was like, come.
No. As soon as your dad told me, just the tip of the iceberg about what you're up to, I was like, absolutely, bring her along. This will be a lot of fun.
Thank you.
So go ahead and tell me all about what you're doing.
Yeah, I'm in LA right now. Well, I'm not. I'm here right now, but in LA is on fire. But I've been in LA for the past like almost 4 years, and growing up around musical people, obviously this guy and then my mother as well. She was a folk singer-songwriter, and I was born in the peak of her career, totally not on purpose, right?
I was born not on purpose, but, I figured I would put it.
But that's with a song love, lyric right no, there, right? I mean, yeah, like, mistake.
She's
you know?
Our beautiful mistake.
Yeah, but it's funny because it's just always been around. And I think I used to, like, I never did classical guitar lessons or anything like that. Not because they didn't tell me, like, they tried to encourage me to learn music and to get really into it. But because they were telling me to, I was like, no.
Yeah, oh, sure. Yes.
But I came to it on my own terms and at my own time. And I was always really into painting and drawing and stuff as a little kid. And used to love dancing and, like 5 years old in a little tube top thinking I was, like, hot shit, you know? And it took a really long time for me to get to actually writing and performing music more on my own. But when I did, it became pretty clear that that's something that I really wanted to do more of. And I eventually, at the end of high school, I was between either doing this AmeriCorps, like a volunteer thing, or Berklee. And I found out from both of them at the same on the same night. And I got a little scholarship to Berklee. I was no Phil. I was no Phil about it, but I got some help to go there and ultimately decided that that was the move. And I auditioned with the prospect of doing music therapy because I've always just really wanted to be of service. And my first year there, I ended up doing this talent show thing. And a few different producers like started asking me to do vocal work for them. And then I kind of just... not accidentally is the wrong word, but definitely not fully intentionally started an artist career by featuring on like DJ songs and like more electronic music and stuff like that. And my parents, I'm so lucky to have parents that are so supportive and absolutely understand the creative world. They were like, you know, like you can probably help more people by writing music that means something to you.
No, I remember one conversation when Amelia called from Berklee. I think it was freshman year, and she said, "I'm stressing out. Like I gotta get this paper done." And I'm like, and she's like, you know, I want to get good grades because I want to be in music therapy. And I'm like, honey, I'm like, why don't you just do music? I'm like, you're born with a gift. Why don't you at least give it everything you got so you don't have any regrets? And if you want to be a therapist later, go to BU, get a degree. Become a therapist. But for now, while you're amongst all these musicians, because that's the part that I didn't get when I was there.
Yeah.
Why don't you do like 14 co-writes a semester instead of worrying about your grades? And I'm like, why don't you go find out from the scholarship department what you really need to keep your scholarship? And it was like, what, 2.0 or something? It was really low. It was like, okay.
Yeah,
this isn't an issue anymore, you know? And basically, you know, like just get everything you can out of it. Everybody you meet there is going to be your future people that you work with.
And, yeah.
Mind you saying all of this, it definitely, like, I know you think I don't listen, perhaps.
No, you
think
listen.
That when it's your child. Well, I mean, it's funny to hear you say that because I feel like that is my, that's my entire Berklee experience is the people that I met and the people that I worked with, even if I wasn't consciously thinking of it at the time as like, oh, I'm doing as my dad said, blah, blah, blah.
See, for me, when I went there, it was like having every argument in every band that I'd ever been in resolved for me. And because I was, every time
it's
I,
the same
every
language.
Every class was, I was learning something. And it was like, ah, I wish I knew that. Oh, I wish I knew this. And they have a way of teaching you. Everybody has to go through the first year of the same theory and the same harmony and the first 2 years, two semesters of, two, four semesters of advanced theory, advanced harmony, and you learn this common language. So when you talk about music, it's fast, and you learn to just play things and listen to them. And, and how I wish I'd known that when I was, because I was in original bands in California, and it was always really frustrating. And now it's like, oh, wow, now there's this common language to do this. Mm-hmm. So. Mm-hmm. But anyway, I just remember that conversation saying, like, look, why don't you just go for it? Like, why? This isn't real college. This is music school. Like, right. Anyway, go ahead.
Maybe it's mom who summarized it then and said, you can probably help more people by writing songs that mean something to you. Because I just remember that whole conversation definitely just I was like, oh, permission to, cause I don't know. I think growing up, like, especially just being a girl in America, just like, my worth comes from supporting other people or from being kind or from being whatever. Mm-hmm. And it's funny because I've been pursuing an artist career for like 7 years now. And still, like, only the past couple years have I been able to admit out loud to myself, I'd like to succeed in this career, and I'd like to connect with as many people as possible. Like, I'd never felt comfortable saying something like, oh, I want to be famous or something like that. It's never felt, like, that's never been a resonant thing to say, because it's always felt like a selfish thing. But the way that they helped me understand it, it's like, connecting with other people isn't selfish. Like, yeah, it is. It's helping you too.
Oh, sure.
But you know, it's bigger than that. It's a deeper connection than just a one thing. Cause on one hand of being an artist, it's like going inward and like all of this exploration and like pain at times. And then the other hand of it is like having to ask people to look at you and to like what you're doing and be like, hey, here's like my heart. You like it, you know, like, and it's so funny because like, yeah, as I get older, the more I feel, comfortable admitting what I do and admitting what I want out of this career. Because when I was younger, I was just so in denial of wanting to do anything selfish. I never wanted to seem self-serving or anything. Meanwhile, I'm pursuing an artist career, which is like, just so silly. It's a silly combo, you know?
Yeah.
But
I mean, once you've had the experience of actually moving people in a performance where you really feel the connection.
Yeah.
I mean, for me, it's addictive. If I don't get in front of people playing music that I can connect to people with.
Yeah.
Every 2 months I'll go insane.
Yeah.
It has to be like every, I'm right if it's every week.
Yeah.
I'm a little off. It's every 2 weeks.
Right.
If it's more than 2 months, I need therapy.
Yeah, this is a common thread because I've interviewed a lot of people now, and I'd say 75% are musicians, most of them friends of mine, that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. But the common thread is exactly that there's this addictive quality to it, and it's not like, you know, it's very interesting perspective for you to talk about selfishness and being self-serving. And it really isn't about that, is it?
No.
It seems that way
on
the surface. And I think to a lot of people that are looking at a performer, they think, well, they're just all about them. But what you just spoke about, Phil, in when you feel that connection, when you make someone feel something, and it only needs to be one person.
Yeah.
You know, I often find myself in a crowded room full of people singing to one person.
Yeah.
You know, and that's all that it matters. So for me, I don't care if the room is full.
Yeah.
As long as someone is there enjoying it, that's all that really matters. But I really appreciate that you brought that up because no one has expressed it quite like that yet. Oh, so that's,
thank you.
That's great.
Thanks for the space. Yeah. And on top of that, I think, as I get older and looking at it, it's more the fear of thinking people are going to think that I'm selfish, right? Mm-hmm. That people are going to, you know, think that I think that I'm worthy or something. And I'm like, as I get older, I'm like, oh, well, I don't think anyone gives, I don't think anyone cares. And that's the
But even if they
most,
do.
Yeah, it's so liberating to
really
realize
doesn't
really
mean
that.
Anything to you. It's like,
correct.
In a way, it might even help them because whatever's wrong with them, they need to feel that you're being selfish.
And times where I've judged other, you know, friends of mine who are ahead of me in whatever ways, like friends that I've looked up to or had success faster, there were times where I can look back and be like, oh, I was judging them at this time because I wasn't down to do that. I wasn't down to advocate for myself, so I was judging them. And it's so obvious in hindsight.
Yeah.
But it's cool to be able to look back and to do something, to commit as so much time to something that you're able to look back and be like, that was silly.
Well, it's hard being a parent. yeah. in this situation. It's extremely hard I want her to experience the things I've experienced.
Mm-hmm.
And she may not because she's not the same person.
Yeah.
But there's so much I've gotten out of touring and playing
mm-hmm.
that I always tell people, like, there's no better experience for any job on earth than being in a band that tours for like 10 years
mm-hmm.
and tries to get a record deal.
Yeah.
You better get really used to failing.
Yeah.
You better get really used to showing up and putting a show on no matter what
mm-hmm.
the situation is. You get used to hell. You get used to living with the same six people all the time, you know, but there is no substitute for that. You know, I've run a couple of big music companies. I sold one and worked for their corporation in the corporate world for
mm-hmm.
18 months. It was hell.
Yeah.
But the funniest thing in this world is they're a music company with 140 people working for them, and they don't know how to improvise.
Yeah.
It was like, you know, do presentations at NAMM, and everybody be getting uptight about cue cards, and like, we need to practice our speeches. And I'd walk out there like, where's your cue cards? I'm like, I don't have any cue cards.
Right.
I got like 6 points I need to make, and all I need to do is connect with how many thousand people are standing there watching me, because if I bore them, then we've sold nothing, you know? And it's like...
But you do have the advantage of having been a performer.
Oh, exactly.
I have the unique advantage of train wrecking a big band in front of 14,000 people in Japan. I've made that fatal error.
Yeah.
And I've lived through it.
Lived through it.
And now, really, it's very difficult to get embarrassed for anything.
Sure.
You know?
Yeah.
Or should I say, be terrified of being embarrassed?
Right.
Because this too shall pass, you know?
Yeah.
He's always said to me, and I'm so grateful for this, fail fast, fail fast, fail fast, fail fast.
Yeah.
And there's, like, obviously you can try not to fail. You can spend a lot of time trying not to fail. But then the second you do, the second you make an ass of yourself or say the wrong thing, you're like, oh, it happened. I'm still alive.
Mm-hmm.
Ooh, I could have found that out a lot faster. And then maybe I'd be further right now. But, like, everything has to happen at its own pace. But fail fast has been so valuable to have someone that I look up to say that to me, you know?
That's like the entrepreneur's mantra in... Everybody, I mean, I've met a lot of really amazing, wealthy people. I had a company that had over $5 million invested by angel investors. And that was like getting an MBA, but it was also like having these guys around who would tell you their stories. And man, the number one thing on top of it all was just fail quickly. Like, just don't sit there trying to make a decision. If you can't make a decision, just make one, go there. If it failed, now you got an answer. You move on.
If it's not going to work, then let it not
and
work.
Man,
really
I wish somebody had like done that for me when I was young.
Yeah.
Because I can look back at my life and say every time I hesitated or took the conservative route, I lost.
Yeah. Well, I'm paraphrasing, but I think it was fairly certain Teddy Roosevelt said the best thing is to make the right decision, the next best thing is to make the wrong decision, and the very worst thing is to make no decision at all, to not act.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And especially in business, it's brutal. And I wrote a course called Entrepreneurship for Musicians and taught it at a couple of colleges. And it basically took, you know, 14 weeks for you to give me your business plan as a musician and give me your plan for your life. And at the end, you had to present how the two things went together.
Mm-hmm.
And how, because so many friends of mine let their lives take over their musical ambitions and ruin it, or their musical ambitions ruin their lives.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, my wife, Barbara, we just went with it. You know, she just had a record produced by, Peter Gabriel's drummer, Jerry Murata. And it was distributed by Rounder, and it was doing really well. And she's in the middle of that record release, gets pregnant, and like, you want to have a kid? I want to have a kid. Let's have a kid. So I quit the band I've been touring with for 10 years and I go on the road with her.
Yeah.
And this kid was born. I think Barb took off. She played through her eighth month.
Mm-hmm.
Sympathy sales were huge. And then she took off 4 months, and then she was back at it. And yeah. we were out in the road with this little baby. But we just did what we had to do because that was it. So, like, I was still playing drums. I was just playing with my wife now instead of yeah. playing in this other band.
Yeah.
And we ended up putting a trio together, and we're out with her. And I think she had, like, one of the coolest upbringings till she was five, where she was out on the road all the time, meeting all sorts of different people. She had no qualms about hanging around with different people. And
yeah, that was just the context of which I was born.
A 2-year-old tearing apart a hotel room is perfect. You know, it's like and
it's like a little mini Keith Moon, right?
Yeah, it's like yeah. It was really cool. And
throw that Fisher Price television right out the window.
No, that's funny. No, you know, we went from like. Literally, like maybe a month of trying to pre-reserve cribs and mm-hmm. you know, like we're using those newspapers to pick notes back. It was before,
yeah,
you know, before yeah. the internet, really. You know, it quickly became like, you know, you just take a drawer and you throw a bunch of blankets in it, and it's just as good as a crib.
No, that's wild. Like,
and somebody hipped us to that, like it's some, and you know, you're going to folk festivals and big music, you know, like world music festivals, and that's where all the hippies are, and that's when you get all the great advice from raising kids. You know, they're like, oh no, hold on to her all the time, she'll run away from you, you know. So we'd smother her with love, and she'd be like, yeah, okay, I have enough of you guys, you know.
Yeah. Like, hey, that's awesome. I've never heard that perspective.
Oh yeah, and I mean, there was only one time I remember where she, you know, she would be in a baby bucket side of the stage and just fall asleep.
Mm.
And that was kind of her MO, was when Barb was playing with her and she's in the womb, she'd get quiet when Barb played her gig. And then after the gig, she'd be awake. So, like, all you had to do when she was born was put her mom's music on and the kid would just fall asleep.
Wow.
It was amazing.
And
how funny.
Fast forward, I couldn't listen to my mom's music, like, as soon as I gained consciousness, I could not listen to my mom's music without bawling. And that went through, like, beginning of college is when I started coming back to folk music. And I just couldn't listen to it before that. I was too emotionally affected.
If she heard any song in a minor key when she was a baby, she'd start crying.
Wow.
It was a trip.
As a baby, I was crying, too.
Yeah,
all right.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. No, it makes sense. And it's funny because that's my favorite music. At least to make for myself, it tends to be more stripped as I get older. Like, I've worked on a lot of EDM stuff as well, but more inward stuff is what I love to make. And it's funny because it's rarely what I listen to, because again, it's just like I'm too spongy about it.
Yeah.
It feels too much, and it makes sense. Yeah.
So I, you know, we kind of came into this cold. I literally meeting you folks just now for the first time.
That's fun.
It is fun, and I'm really enjoying this. Honestly,
me too.
What are you writing? What kind of music are you writing exactly? And
yeah, I would blanket call it pop because I'm trying to make songs that people can remember.
Mm-hmm.
But stuff that I write for me is more like flow of consciousness, folk, weird, whatever it is, it's what it is. And I write a lot with other people and for other people too in LA. And so that's a lot of pop and some R&B and definitely EDM stuff. Like, I do a lot of features on electronic tracks.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of what got me started. But yeah, the stuff that I write for myself and the stuff that feels like a part of me is just what it is. It's just strange. And it's folk inspired always. It's very emotional, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So is your main instrument, you sing naturally, right?
Pretty much just vocal.
You play the guitar or the piano or anything like
that? Very poorly I play the guitar. And I have no excuse. Yeah. No, stop it. I'm sure you're great. What I produce on my own, which isn't so much, I sort of learned Ableton is my DAW, not Pro Tools, but what I do know of Ableton, it's like I learned what I learned and then my brain shut off any new information. So, like, I don't really use MIDI or synths or anything.
Okay.
When I work on my own, I use my voice as all the instruments.
Oh.
And it's been really fun. And it's, I don't know, like, I don't think of it as limiting. Just using my voice as the instrument, I'll chop it up and I'll make the arrangement of what I want, and then I will send it to someone I trust who's a better producer than me to help me clean it up and to flesh it out and stuff. But for the most part,
You're using your voice for all of the instruments. So can you give me an example? And I'll have to get some of the music, and if I can find time, I'll try to include it in the podcast.
But
you'll hear, like, I'll hear demos of hers, and it'll sound like a keyboard, but mm-hmm. she actually sang the chords and then picked something to distort it, and, like, that was it.
Right.
Like, and they're like, what the hell's that sound, you know, or what, you know.
In Ableton, there's just this really simple function. It's a pitch up and down. Yep. You can warp it up to 24 steps up and whatever, down. So, like, I'll record my, I'll be like,
yeah.
And then I'll pitch it down 12, and it's, like, it's my 808. You know?
Okay, yeah,
and I love doing that too, because it ends up with the weird quality that people will be like, what is that? And I'll be like, oh, you want some of that? You know?
Yeah.
And then they can do whatever, you know what I mean? Like, I think one of my favorite things about Berkeley and then LA is knowing that I don't have to do everything by myself.
Mm.
And a lot of the time my music, or music in general, just benefits from having different perspectives and different hands. And, like, if you're good at one thing, great. Like, you don't have to do everything. Like, let other people make your best better, you know? And so I work with a lot of different producers and writers who make my best better all the time.
And it's going pretty well.
Thanks, Dad.
Yeah, but I know you don't want to self-promote. I get it.
No, it's going.
But the kiddo's got a million listeners a month on Spotify. It's not scratch. What she may not have, she may be honing in on what her sound is, but got a lot of fans. You got a lot of people listening to you and your music and things you get involved in.
Mm.
And it's gonna, like, I'm waiting. I'm a huge fan, but I'm waiting. I'm like, I can see this coming. I can't wait. You know?
He's 1 million of the monthly listeners. He's duplicated himself.
Yeah, I'm one of them.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to become one as well, I think.
Because it really does range from, like, EDM to folk music. Like,
yeah.
What you would call modern folk music.
Emotional pop, you know? It's what it is.
Mm-hmm.
It's really fun that there are no rules and that I can release anything that I enjoy. And I think when I was younger, I used to be like, oh, it has to be this way or it has to be that way. It does not.
Mm.
And listening back through my discography every once in a while, I'll do that. And my older stuff, some of it is so embarrassing to me because I was trying to be a thing. You know what I mean?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Whereas now, like, my goal is to not try to be anything and just to be and to share that with people. Yeah. And the songs that I have released so far that I didn't think anything about and I was just being, those are the ones that have received the most attention.
Isn't that amazing?
Isn't that? Oh, it's so validating. It's like, oh, you mean I have to just, like, express what is already, you know? Like,
it
feels really good. And it's funny how circuitous the path to realizing that is often, you know, and, like, forgetting that and then coming back to it. But, like, authenticity is so key.
Mm-hmm.
Well, this summer, I had the honor and opportunity to back her up in a band.
Oh,
and,
me too.
And it was the coolest experience for a dad, but also just the coolest experience as a drummer that I've had in a long time, because she just approaches drums, you know, ass backwards as far as I'm concerned, right? And she works with people who are all doing programming, and they're all doing the wildest shit with drums. But then we had to perform it, and I'm listening to this stuff, and I'm like, oh, man, wait a minute. What a challenge to try to get the grooves happening, like, with weird delays in them and strange backbeats. And that was really cool. But then on top of that, she approaches her production and music. You know, when she wants you to hear something, she takes everything out.
Yeah.
And that's where, if I was, like, coming up to a chorus, I want to bring it up, bring a fill and introduce the chorus. She takes everything out. So you're like, what? Oh, chorus, you know, like, and it was an absolute blast to have her direct us, watching her know exactly what she wants. It's probably one of the first times I got to witness her producing and being very clear about what she wants and getting it. And it was such a blast.
Thanks, Dad. It's a blast for me, too.
Well, okay. But it was... all right, enough of that.
Speaking of which, in production, now, Phil, you're talking about a live performance, obviously.
Right.
But when you're in the studio and you're working on your musical endeavors, do you find that you have... can you hear the entire song in your head before it's done? Or does it sort of... come in pieces.
I definitely hear things in my head. Wait, oh, I definitely hear things in my head. I don't know. I think, so, sorry. I just made me giggle when I said I hear things in my head. Like,
yeah, you can giggle.
yeah, no. I think so much of the songwriting process for me is like watching it unfold, as cheesy as that sounds. It's really how it goes every time. Like, almost every session that I go to, first of all, I never want to go to because it's like going to the gym. And then I go to the session. I'm like, oh, I'm so glad I went to the session.
Mm-hmm.
But every single time when a song comes out at the end, I'm just like, wow, that didn't exist earlier.
Yeah.
And it wouldn't have unless we all showed up today exactly as we are.
Yeah.
You know? And yeah, so I'll hear things in my head and I will try my best to explain them. And I'm normally to a different producer. Like, for me trying to create that on my own is literally just me using my voice.
Yeah.
But when I'm in a room with other producers, which is like 95% of the time, I'll do my best to explain something. And if people aren't getting it and they're not able to recreate it, a lot of the time I just let it go because there's a reason they're not understanding it. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like, I have to let everybody do what they do best and see what comes from it.
Yeah.
But I like that question. Do you hear things like fully in your head before?
I do.
Yeah.
It's maddening sometimes. I think a lot of, I don't want to speak for all musicians, but
yeah.
If I'm listening to, well, first of all, if a record's really well produced, you know, like I was watching a documentary about Steely Dan the other day.
Oh, cool.
And the Asia record, which is.
No, it's just.
It's just the most amazing.
Just listening to that like a couple days ago.
It's incredible. Yeah. And, you know, so here's these two guys in Steely Dan that are writing this music, and they know exactly what this record's going to sound like way before it was ever even recorded. You can just tell. And I can understand that because that's kind of the way that it happens for me. But when you're listening, it's amazing how you can listen to the same song 8 times in a row, and each time you'll listen to the bass.
Right.
And then you'll listen to the guitar, and then you'll listen to the vocal, then you'll listen to the backing vocal. And it's so well mixed and it's so well produced that all of those parts are blended together perfectly, but they also stand on their own.
Yeah.
And that, to me, is just, it's magic. It can't be explained. Maybe someone could explain it, but that would ruin it, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
That would ruin the magic.
Totally.
But it really is. It's just, it's such a wonderful thing, and I love the fact that you just said that half an hour ago this didn't exist. And I never really thought of that. And I have a very good friend of mine. He produced my record, Roger.
Oh, nice.
LaValle, and I write songs just about every single day.
Oh,
and I'll send him a demo, just guitar, me singing, you know.
Yep.
And he'll say that didn't exist 20 minutes ago, that was not part of the universe, and now
it is.
That's
cool.
Isn't that beautiful?
And that's a really, how wonderful is that, right?
How humbling, too.
Yeah.
You're just like, look at the thing I made. That's what's so cool about painting, too. Like, I see your painting. Like, do you get song ideas while you're painting, and vice versa?
Oh yeah.
I'm the same way, and one really inspires the other.
Mm-hmm.
And for all my musician friends, I'm always trying to get them to come over and have, like, a paint night. I'm like, come be a kid with me. Because, like, it literally, like, it's activating a different part of your brain, you know?
Yeah.
And when you start to treat music like work, you can forget how boundless, like, your creations can be. You know what I mean? Like, there's no rules.
Right.
And it's easy to think that there are sometimes when you're trying to make money from something.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah. If you go into it with this expectation that you're going to make a living, you're doing it wrong. It's too bad because musicians are woefully underpaid until they become megastars, and they provide so much joy to everyone, you know.
Yeah, and remembering the providing the joy thing is what keeps me going, because I forget that sometimes.
Yeah.
It's like, it gives me joy, right? Like, I think have you heard of The Art of You by James McRae?
I have, yeah.
Okay, have you listened to it? Have you read it?
I started listening to it, but I haven't.
I hope you listen to it on one of your drives or something. I've listened to it like 3 times now, just trying to like sponge it and absorb it in. But there's this one part where he says, it's not about you being good at creativity. It's about creativity being good for you.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, that's so true.
Yeah.
And everyone forgets, because most of my friends, I'm really lucky to have a lot of really good friends from high school and from growing up still. And all of them have like big kid jobs for the most part, you know? And I'll be like, man, like, you know, you're allowed to do other stuff. They're like, oh, well, I can't draw. Like, I'm not coming over to paint. I'm like, well, yes, you can.
Mm-hmm.
It's really not about you being good at it. Like, whatever, you know, it's pretty fun. It's fun.
It's fun. Yeah. So, that's another thing that, I learned when you first came in. You're an artist, you're a painter.
For fun. Yeah.
Yeah. For fun.
Yeah.
Okay. But you were dragged away from painting to come here. That was the story.
I was. Yeah. Whenever I have free time and I can convince myself to not rot on my phone, I love to paint and to draw.
I'm trying to get her to put her art up with
my Spotify canvases.
The Spotify canvases for each song to put picture her and then her art.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes even to start trying to tie her art to the song.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because what better format to introduce her art to people? It might move people in a different way.
So what types of mediums do you paint in?
Watercolor and whatever I'm staying with my parents right now, extra long because of the condition of LA right now.
Mm.
We've got like this art drawer of just paints that don't go together. So I'm using like liquid watercolor with oil paints and stuff. I'm just using what I got.
Wow.
But in my little place in LA, I have a ton of like half my room is just crafts, arts and crafts. And a lot of watercolor, a lot of acrylic. And I love like older magazines. So I'll cut up like older magazine photos from like 50s, 60s, and then I'll paint around them. And I don't know. I feel like a little bird. I just like grab things that look cool to me and put them on a thing and then do a thing, you know? And I used to draw like before I could speak, right? That's what mom was gassing me up yesterday. Yeah, she was like,
crazy.
You used to like, when I used to read you books, you used to not let me like turn the page. You didn't give a fuck about the story. You just wanted to look at the picture and like,
You're a wacky kid.
I was a weirdo. And I look at all my old pictures of me like drawing when I was like 3 or 4. And it's just all these ladies with boobies. All these ladies. It was basically just like high heels and like just all the things that I gravitated towards as a child, which is so funny. And I actually use paintings that I did as a like a really small kid of ladies with boobies. I use those as my my cover art for a project that I released a few years ago called Girls Like You.
Mm-hmm.
And I had written all these songs, and I realized in hindsight that they are all kind of like, it read as this a poem. Like, I didn't plan for this, but if you read the EP track, it's like, because beautiful, quiet girls like you love the ocean. And then in parentheses, don't take my power. Those are just the names of all the songs. And when they were all done, I was like, oh my God. It's like all the things I tried to be as a little kid, and all the things that like little girls see and then they want to be like, before I could speak, I was drawing women because I was like, ah, to be a woman. Like, you know, just like how glorious is that? And so it's really funny to look back and see the way that I was trying to express that, even as like an unformed
She has
human.
A sister, and both of them, I used to always whisper to them before they went to bed. I'm like, just remember, you have all the power.
Yeah.
And I wonder if that's how that's going to look. I'm sorry.
Oh, well, my sister has all the power.
Yeah, she's a piece of work.
Yeah, my sister's also incredibly powerful and creative.
We're very entertained by our children.
I can see that. As you should be.
Yeah, I guess that's why they're here, to entertain us.
That's right. Well, I can't thank you guys enough for coming and doing this with me. I know that we could go on and talk.
Yeah,
we certainly can. I'm going to stop recording pretty soon because my show, sadly, is only an hour long.
Understood. Well, mine, you're going to have to splice the heck out of it.
Stop.
To make any sense whatsoever. Cause that
it was great.
Pretty much historical vomit. It was like...
Stop it.
No, I appreciate a guest where I don't have to pull things out of them and ask a lot of questions. It's nice when people feel comfortable and know what they want to talk about. So
thank you for having us. It's an honor to be here with my dad.
Oh, no, totally appreciate it.
I'm going to drop this in somewhere. Where specifically can people find your music?
Yes. Okay, so my music is on all streaming platforms. It's Emilia Ali, EmiliaAli, on Spotify, on iTunes, on YouTube, SoundCloud. All those things.
And you're on social media?
I am. I'm on Instagram as Emilia Ali, and that's pretty much the social media I use. I'm okay. on Facebook, but I'm not.
Yeah. You're not 58 years old, so you're not on Facebook. Yeah.
I wasn't going to say it.
She's on Facebook when I post pictures of her from my friends.
If I'm lucky, if I see it. No, yeah.
A website or no?
You know, also have a website. Thank you, Phil. He really tried to get me on there, but I don't know how to edit it, and it's been the same for years.
Yeah.
So Instagram, that's where you'll find me.
Okay.
TikTok's a disaster and probably getting deleted in 9 days, so whatever. But Amelia Ollie on all the above.
Yeah. Okay.
Thank you for asking.
Thank you. And thanks so much for coming. This has been an absolute pleasure to have you both here.
Aww. Yeah, it's great to meet you.
Back at you.
You've been listening to Beautiful Minds, an exploration into the minds of creative people and what makes them tick. This program is a production of Audio Journal, a proud member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network. Please remember, we would love to hear from you. Are there any local musicians or artists that you'd like to hear about? Please call or email us with any suggestions or general feedback at 508-797-1117 or email us at info@audiojournal.org. I'm Tom Hurley, and thanks for listening. And before I sign off, as always, I'd just like to say that I'm grateful for the universe and whatever put us all here. I'm grateful for all of the gifts that it's given me. And I'm grateful for you being here with me today. Have a great day.
Hi, my name's Owen Devlin, and this is my story. When my doctor told me I was losing my vision, I was devastated. I worried about my future. How would I attend college, find a great job, start a family, or even travel around my own neighborhood? Luckily, my doctor also told me about the Mass Commission for the Blind. They connected me and my family to a counselor who helped us to set a vision for my future, one that included assistive technology to allow me to go to school and find a meaningful job, a white cane to help me navigate, and even tips on how to use Google Maps on my mobile phone. I found out that losing my vision wasn't the end of the world.
If your loved one is blind or visually impaired, find out if they are eligible to register for services. Call 1-800-392-6450 or visit mass.gov/MCB. That's 1-800-392-6450 or visit mass.gov/MCB.
Welcome to Everyday Poems for Every Day, sponsored by Audio Journal. Our poem today is Don't Quit by John Greenleaf Whittier. When things go wrong as they sometimes will, when the road you're trudging seems all uphill, when the funds are low and the debts are high, and you want to smile but you have to sigh, when care is pressing you down a bit, rest if you must, but don't you quit. Life is queer with its twists and turns, as every one of us sometimes learns, and many a failure turns about when he might have won had he stuck it out. Don't give up, though the pace seems slow. You may succeed with another blow. Success is failure turned inside out, the silver tint of the clouds of doubt. And you never can tell how close you are. It may be near when it seems so far. So stick to the fight when you're hardest hit. It's when things seem worst that you must not quit. For all the sad words of tongue or pen, the saddest are these, it might have been. You've been listening to Everyday Poems.